If you see something, say something. At Reply, weird things come with any weird story you find on the web, and you can help make weirdthings.com even weirder.
Mike Ray, former cop and body double for a world-famous action star, was ready to put show business behind him when he was asked to do one last favor for Hollywood's hottest new actress. All he had to do was find her the necklace from a forgotten film and not get killed in the process. From the insane house parties of Malibu and the reclusive mansions of Beverly Hills to the scorching California desert, Mike finds himself in a scandal involving one of the world's most eccentric billionaires, the Nevada Mafia, and a sadistic Estonian porn kingpin. To find the necklace, he'll have to blow the lid off a secret buried in the California desert that stretches back to ancient Egypt, with an irresistible client who won't take no for an answer. The job doesn't get him killed, she just might. Hollywood Pharaohs by Andrew Main has been described as a fast-paced love child of The Big Lebowski and Indiana Jones. Find out why readers have made this book one of the best reviewed in all of Amazon. It's Hollywood Pharaohs by Andrew Main, available for only $2.99 on the Amazon Kindle store. Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to a very special episode of Weird Things, the podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Main, joined by Mr. Brian Brushwood.
Hello, we're now 100% Justin Robert Young free, except for we're not, because we'll probably hear his voice from the grave.
I don't know who you're talking about.
Wait, who, Justin Robert Young? You're already disowning him?
Our co-host, who's always been and will always be, Dr. Paul Zak, author of the new book, Big Hotness, which I have here in my hands, The Moral Molecule, The Source of Love and Prosperity. And it has got some fantastic quotes on the back. Familiar with Dr. Paul's research, I'm a little bit biased, but Matt Ridley, author of Genome, writes, Paul Zak tells the remarkable story of how he discovered and explored the biochemistry of sympathy, love, and trust with the narrative skills of a novelist. Philosophy, economics, and biology have rarely been so entertaining. Another one of my favorites, Tyler Cowan, writes, Paul Zak's investigations of the best things in life are inspired, rigorous, and tremendous fun. We need more daring economists like him. So Paul Zak is the rarest of a breed. He's both skilled in neuroscience and economics.
And he's good looking to boot. He's got that chiseled jaw.
For our audio listeners, imagine Christopher Reeves and Jeff Goldblum from Jurassic Park kind of combined together.
Yeah,
I'm getting a real gay vibe now, so I'm a little uncomfortable with you guys.
Look, we don't call it Weird Things for nothing.
And listen, you signed up for this show.
Wait, I thought it was Justin Young. I'm confused.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys. Yeah, great to be on with you. I have a little surprise, actually. You know, the UK loves the crazy, covers for books. So, Andrew, hold up your cover, the U.S. cover.
All right. My cover, it's a really nice cover. It's in very bold letters is The Moral Molecule. Yes. It's text with some nice orange lines sort of highlighting it. Available on Amazon, by the way.
Look at this.
What?
Oh, it's like, wow. Is that Paul's cover?
Is that like a blood drinking?
It is.
Flask, some ampule or something. Very interesting.
No, it looks like a milk bottle, like an old-fashioned, that the milkman would deliver, but it's filled with blood.
Perfectly. Yeah, it's a milk bottle.
That's awesome.
With blood coming down. It's all about the oxytocin. How about that? So my U.S. publisher saw this cover. I said, let's do this in the U.S. He said, you won't sell a single copy. People will freak out.
That's awesome.
So, real quick, Paul, could you give us your radio show explanation of your book? Now, dumb it down for us. I mean, like, really, really dumb it down.
Yeah, as we pointed out before, we don't call the show Smart Things. It's called Weird Things.
So there are weird people out there. You guys are included in that group. Not all of them are good and bad, right? Some are just interesting and odd and strange, but some actually are bad, right? So we know a lot about bad behavior. We don't know a lot about the good behavior, right? So if the three of us were in a room, you know, of course we'd battle it out a couple of times and hit each other. But if we put a bunch of rats in a room, right, fur would fly. So why don't human beings do that? How do we actually get along with other people? And that getting along is actually really key because it lets us extract value from social relationships, right? Yeah. So we can actually interact with anybody on the planet just about and very quickly go, hey, Brian, great guy, love to be around him. Andrew, sketchy, got to stay away from him. How do I do that?
Well, and so I guess, I mean, it's one of those things where we, of course, hear all the stories about the socially aberrant behavior, the killers and the rapists and so on. But as a statistic, it is shocking how good we all are. And I think specifically about just driving down the street, how many billions of cars passing through each other, you know, if you count every car passing every other car, separated by, what, 8 inches of a painted yellow line and a loose agreement that we're not going to run into each other. Why is the whole world not as crazy as you think it should be?
Yeah, in fact, you know, further than that, you pull over and let the guy go in front of you, right? And he gives you a little thank you wave. And then if you don't get the thank you wave, you're pissed, right? So why is that? So I discovered this chemical in the brain called oxytocin that is released when we get this positive social signal. And it says, hey, this guy's like one of the family. Treat him okay. Be nice to him. And once that's released, then we have this sort of 20-minute interval where we're kind of connecting to other people in a very relaxed way. What we found over 10 years with the laboratory experiments is that thing is released, this chemical is released in zillions of experiences, from weddings to monks meditating to people dancing to indigenous people doing tribal dances. So all these rituals, all these behaviors are meant to bring us together. And when we do that, again, we get lots of value from that.
So there's got to be a spectrum of activities that induce a different level of jolt of oxytocin in you, you know, creating this different bonding feeling. I guess at the low end, you've got the leaning over and establishing eye contact with someone from car to car. And at the high end, obviously getting married. Have you studied where some of the other activities fall as far as the amount that it releases?
We have. And I should say the amount that you release essentially tells you about the relationship with that person, right? So, you know, one of the potent releases of oxytocin is, in fact, sex. So, right, you feel really close to that person for like 10 minutes. And then if you're a guy, and then, you know,
and then you go to sleep, and then that's it.
In fact, you know, for every experiment we've run, women release more oxytocin than men do, and they're subsequently nicer. Like, we know that.
Right? Yeah.
So, yes, there's a whole range of behavior. So, for example, in the wedding experiment I did, this is a real wedding where the bride was a reporter for a science magazine, invited me to come. I took blood from the bride and the groom and the wedding party, the family and the friends. And we could map out how related people were to the bride by the release of oxytocin. Right? Who's closest to the bride? Her mom, of course. And then the groom's father, then the groom, the family, the friends. They're arrayed around her like planets around the sun. So we find the same thing that happens with social media, by the way. So right now, you guys are getting some love from the followers online, and they're releasing oxytocin, you're releasing oxytocin, you're saying, hey, you know, I'm with my people. I'm happy.
Well, so how long does that do these feelings of bonding last? Is it a case where oxytocin in the long term kind of generates a substantial bond that can be measured later? Or is it like, as I would imagine, a dopamine rush where it's like, I feel this way at this minute, but I might not feel this way, you know, next week?
I didn't know we were going to have a neuroscientist on here with me. These are hard questions.
I read a comic book about neuroscience once.
So this is exactly right. So in the human brain, unlike most other mammals, this oxytocin system that motivates us to engage with people activates the release of these reward chemicals and says, oh, keep doing this. This is awesome. This feels good. So there's this feedback loop in which it motivates us to do good by making it feel good to do so. So all this thing sets up that, and you know, when you've been on the planet long enough, hey, this is the way the humans behave. If I'm a total jerk and I punch Andrew in the nose, well, he's not going to be wanting to be around me, and he'll tell all his other friends.
But I'll high-five you, though.
Yeah. It'll be fun, though. I mean, I'll enjoy it. In fact, one of the potent inhibitors of oxytocin is the most interesting chemical to the three of us, testosterone.
Oh, sure.
And we do experiments. We give testosterone to men, compare themselves on placebo. They become more selfish and more entitled.
Wait, so this is a chemical reason for the reputation men have of being more closed off and don't open themselves to relationships. That's amazing. That's fantastic. Wow.
Except what happens to testosterone? As you get older, it starts to fall after age 30. So Andrew hasn't had that yet. As you get into a committed relationship, it falls further. When you have kids, it falls further. And I don't have evidence for this, but my experience is if you have girl children at home, your testosterone goes to zero. You become a big girly man because you're picking out dresses all day. So
I've got two daughters at home, and we have a third something on the way that may turn out to be a daughter as well.
You're a big girly man too.
I know.
My brother has two daughters, and he's FBI, and he's on the SWAT team, yet... I would certainly say there's been a softening effect there.
He's on SWAT team, hug patrol.
Yeah, exactly.
Get over here, you big lug.
Let us in! Hug time.
We're very disappointed in you.
So anyway, the system has motivated us to, you know, respond strongly when we need to, you know, aggress, be you know, dangerous, but also be nurturing, be... you know, bonding. So Brian and I, we were just saying off air that we haven't seen each other for about 2 years, but we had so much fun when we were hanging out a couple of years ago in LA. We just kicked around and we've been staying in touch since. Why? Right, again, rats just don't do that.
So is it a case where, like, the moment I saw your face and the moment we remembered hanging out at the Magic Castle and I felt this, like, man, we really did have a good time. I mean, is that I'm feeling an oxytocin rush just then?
Pretty likely.
Wow.
So even movies do it to us. Like you guys don't do this, but like I cry at movies.
Oh, dude, are you kidding me? I cry when I hear about people going to movies. It's so beautiful.
That's right.
They're watching moving pictures.
That's right. So anyway, it's the same kind of thing. So any of those little social stimuli that go bring back that good feeling or create a good feeling, all of a sudden you're like, oh, I'm going to be around my people. Where are they? You know?
Now, do people? Oh, here's one I got for you. Can you induce an oxytocin rush? I can't even say the word with fake beings. Like, or I guess you said that if you cry at the movie or whatever. But like, can people feel a bond or kinship with like stuffed animals or toys and that kind of stuff? Or is that the kind of thing there needs to be someone else doing something to cause it? I don't know.
You need a teddy? Should I wait for you to get? we don't know. So
okay.
It looks like it's got to be human. So we've tried non-human stimuli. They don't seem to work so well. We did a crazy experiment. So we thought about what about the greatest protection figure in the world, James Earl Jones, speaking as the voice of God? Doesn't work. Okay, so anyway, you know, some things are just too far. So it doesn't work. It sounds like really Darth Vader talking to you.
Wow. What I was saying, though, is that, you know, I was just up at Disney World and watching the reactions of children as they ran up to go hug the different characters, whether it be Mickey Mouse, whatever. And this was the last weekend for Star Wars weekends. And they had a Princess Leia, a very, very hot Princess Leia, I'm going to say, and an R2-D2. And I'm trying to think, like, who did I respond more to?
Princess Leia, of course.
Yes,
right, it's the same
that's
thing.
What
it's
I'm going to stick
sense
with.
Of, man, I got to connect with this thing. So, I mean, I think Brian's idea is right. We can actually do a test and see if stuffed animals release oxytocin for kids or for adults or whomever. So, yeah, it's possible, right, if you anthropomorphize it. So you guys know there's this famous psychology experiment from, like, the 1930s of these little triangles and balls moving around chasing each other. And everybody who's healthy anthropomorphizes that little video and said, oh, the big triangle's so mean, he's beating up the little triangle, whatever. So, you know, we name our cars, you know? Like, we spend tons of money saving our pets. What's the deal with that? Why wouldn't a stuffed animal do it?
Right.
Sure.
Right.
Probably.
Crazy.
Well, this is perfect because this actually leads into the first segment we're going to get into here.
Awesome. Bring it. Let's get weird.
All right. So we're going to do a little scenario. Imagine, if you will, okay? It's going to be we're going to ask for, we're going to get some different points of view. Dr. Zach, we're going to get your take on it. We're going to get Brian's defense of this. And I think that we may actually figure out why we may get into a interspecies man versus robot war from the evidence we develop right here.
Perfect.
I'm on Team Robot, by the way.
Hey, Brian's wife, the lovely Bonnie, unlocks the front door to the house. She hears Brian making some interesting sounds. She hears some mechanical sounds. She walks into the bedroom and finds Brian in the throes of passion with the robot house cleaner that happens to look like a French maid.
This is shockingly close to something that can happen in households across America right now.
So, you know, remember the robot maid from the Jetsons, but a much more attractive version. So
no, robot. I'm cool with Rosie. Well, it'll actually be Rosie the robot.
Brian, I like my
Roomba a lot, honestly.
So, question, ethical question, is he cheating?
Depends what his wife thinks. Does she join in or not? I mean, that would be the question.
Man, I guess.
I don't know what to think.
Yeah, in fact, she calls you. She's so upset. She calls you to ask because, like, you know, maybe she calls you and she's like, look, if it's not some just dumb object, you know, if it was just a dumb object, then, you know, I would think of it in one category of sexual activity. But he was calling her name and he was like, Rosie, and clearly had something in his eyes. Is that cheating?
Yeah, if you have feelings, I think. That's the issue. That's what women always say, right? Say, oh, look, it was just a physical thing. I didn't really care. But if you have feelings for Rosie, honey, you're out. Rosie's in. The kids love her. We can just replace
her. They love her. Well, here's the thing I was thinking about is that, you know, like, and we have these science fiction stories where, like, in the future, you know, like, oh, we have robots that act like people, but we're like, oh, they don't have souls. And we as the viewers from the 21st century early part of that go like, of course they do. How could you say that? You're racist or whatever.
Right.
But I finally figured it out. This is what happens. This is how the robot wars happen, and this is how we start mistreating robots. Brian's wife walks in there, sees Brian and throws a passion at the robot.
Right.
Brian's like, hey, it's okay, baby. She's not sentient.
Right.
And she's like, yes, I am. Like, no, you're not. Yes, I am. No, you're not. And then we have to go to war with the robots.
So you're saying it's all husbands covering their backsides. Yes. Well, I'll tell you what. It's one of those things where right now we can see something like, and we'll talk about this later about the movie Prometheus, but one of the best parts of the movie is Michael Fassbender's performance as David, as this really compelling, interesting android. And of course we love Data from Star Trek. And we, you know, respond on side. It's pretty much a person. Look at him. He's happy and joyful and has desires and wants and things, but what lies between us and them is years and years and years of experience and education as to what these things are that would change our opinion if we lived in this future with these robots. So likewise, take something, you know, maybe like a Roomba or something like a stuffed animal that is programmed, you know, to pretend to have personality or whatever, and grab somebody from the 1800s. And if this little stuffed animal goes, I have a soul, that guy is going to be all like, yeah, man, don't choke that bear. It's like it's got a fake soul. And I don't know. I think that we will never believe that robots are sentient because we're too angry when they call us to ask us to take surveys. And we're too angry with them when we talk to them on phones.
We will never believe. Do you mean all of us or do you mean a segment of us will not believe?
I mean humanity in general. I don't think there's anyone right now who feels really, really any kinship for the robot that they talk to when they call Time Warner Cable or the Bank of America. And that is very much a robot conversation with an artificially intelligent being in its crudest form. And all we're going to get from here on out is more refined versions of that interaction.
No, but the refinement is where the rubber hits the road, right? I mean, imagine we have people who are half robot now, right? They have implants. It's creeping roboticism. You're not going to know. Sooner or later, it's going to be like 50% human, 40%, 10%. You know, where do you draw the line?
Man.
And I'll throw something into there. Like Brian, I mean, we will negate other people's humanity when you separate us from them behind a wall. But I was just at Disney, and I got to do the behind-the-scenes tour where they showed the steam engine trains. And the conductor explained to us how each of the locomotives has its own personality and explained that this one, the Lily Bell, or whoever's named for Walt's wife, She does not like having female engineers in there. Says she won't start up. She'll resist. She'll give problems. And anthropomorphizes the steam engine in ways you just could not believe, to the point that you have to think, are you saying this thing's haunted?
Right, but right.
I think that it has to do with how much we like it or not. I mean, when I sit down and I have a conversation with something and I can't tell if it's a human or a robot, I'm going to be willing to say, and not from a lack of evidence, but from just any evidence I could ask for and I can't come to the conclusion, I'm going to personally have to say, it's just as sentient as anybody I know.
Yeah, well, it's that Turing test, right? So, yeah. I don't know. There are people who barely pass the Turing test. I mean, what happens when artificial constructs are more interesting, more engaging than real people?
Bonnie comes home and finds you in the passion throes with Rosie.
Yeah, I guess so.
And the next step is avatars, right? So you get in the passion throes, your avatar and someone else's avatar that you met online. Once you have, you know, feeling vision through the internet, feeling sad, you know, whatever.
Well, so game's over. No, that's
the robots have one, right? The internet's one; it takes over everything.
I guess, but that's a good point. So, say you got a reasonable facsimile of a robot, right? And you also have a person who his every response to every question, every interaction he ever has in his entire life is digitized, recorded, and thrown into a Google-like algorithm that pays attention to the type of stimulus and the type of response this person gets, and it constructs a crude facsimile. Like, you know, given the question, you know, like an obvious question, how is your day today? You know, he is most likely to say this type of sassy answer or whatever. So it's not flat out like stimulus response, always black and white. But instead, it surprises and engages at least to the extent that human being did. Now, it's not the human being. It's just some recording of the types of things he would say. And you inject that into a good looking android. Robot body. I mean, why not fall in love? If you fall in love with a person, you fall in love with a personality and a set of responses. I don't know. Like I think of people, we're sort of feedback loops, you know, like I say something and then it hits your feedback loop that affects what you send back to me, which affects what I send back to you. And it's this perpetual back and forth. And if you can capture 80%, 90%, the majority of what that person is, then why not fall in love with a robot?
Right. I mean, we fall in love with our pets, right? I mean, your dog doesn't do very much. It's just, right? So, you know, imagine if your dog had a voice and said, Brian, I love you. You're the best. You're home. Yay. You know, you'd love it even more, right? So I think the threshold for loving something is very, very low because this oxytocin system is so powerful that makes us connect. Because we have these little parasites that are attached to us for so long called children, we can't get away from them. As much as you try to, you know, leave them on the street, they keep coming back in the door. And so we just have this powerful attachment system. So, I mean, robots, avatars, puppies, dogs,
yes, teddy bears. Let's go and following one of Brian's trains of thought there. And we'll talk about – we'll get into the movie Prometheus later into something like – that'll be when we'll do the spoiler alerts. But one of the things in Ridley Scott – put forth first in the movie Alien and then kind of came up again in Blade Runner was the idea of not making the androids robotic. You cut them open. You didn't find robot. You didn't find gears. You found organs.
Squishy matter. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. And the idea that instead these were androids that were created from organically. And we have projects now like Craig Venter, with his, you know, Celera genomics and different areas there where they start taking, you know, they take like a bacteria and they try to get rid of as many of the parts of the DNA as they can and still have a functioning organism. When we look at the human genome and then we lay it down next to a chimpanzee or orangutan genome, we can see the little differences in the human genome. What if you knock those things out that are human and replace them with something that does kind of the same thing? Or what can we get rid of and we're still human?
Well, I guess, yeah, this is exactly what Paul was talking about in that you know, we're all Borg to some extent, whether it's our contact lenses or our pacemakers. But once you get to a certain functionality, you could do the same thing, the same argument on the cellular level, which is what it sounds like you're describing. Is that what I'm getting?
Yeah, I'm saying, like, you know, if we it's good that we have a neuroscientist here. It's bad for me because now you guys will realize how much I've been bluffing and BSing as much as I possibly can. Then,
you're like, I've been the smartest man. I'm going to use air quotes here. I've been the smartest man in the room on this podcast for far too long.
Now it's come to an end and it's going to shattering end. The lies will be exposed. But when you look at like the human brain and you sort of say the one area we sort of say, okay, physically we see this big difference is like would be like the neocortex, perhaps. And then when you're comparing us to like a chimpanzee or so.
I like the fact that you're looking to Paul.
I'm waiting for an answer.
Like you're like the neocortex. Oh, that's a thing in the brain, right? Right?
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Prefrontal cortex. Yeah, the big planning part of the brain.
So I mean, that's what's the if you look at us from a physical point, that's the thing that just really stands out the most. Is you go, okay, this is what we are.
Yeah, yeah. I guess you're asking where is the essence of personality and how much of it, what part of the brain is the gizmo that pretty much is who we are, and can you replace it with robot parts? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, or you know, what do we? How much do we lose, and then we no longer say it's a human; it's just a bunch of human organs.
Paul. You have to know some stories about this.
Right. So you know, if we bonk you in the head in the right place, then you become a vegetative state, and then. You know, in many senses, the family stops seeing that person as human after just a couple of weeks. I mean, You're just sitting there, you're not interacting, you're not talking. You know, people with Alzheimer's disease, right? I mean, in a very real sense, you are your memories. So if your memories are gone, everything that I shared with you is pretty much gone. You become a shell. And so you actually lose that humanness. As I say, you know, the converse experiment has been done. I was at TED this spring. And a scientist named Heinrich Scharfa made a robot twin of himself, which he calls Geminoid. And when you see Geminoid sitting at a table, he blinks, he moves his head. It is very disconcerting. It's like that, you know, there's this, you know,
the uncanny valley
of uncertainty where you actually don't know if that's a human being or not, who's just like acting like one of those, you know, guys on the stand on the street who's kind of acting like a robot. Or if it's really a robot, and he's so lifelike, like real hair, he moves. It takes you. I mean, it's very aversive, actually. So yeah. So there's a continuum from lifelike robot to vegetative or Alzheimer's patient who has lacked the essence of being human.
So is there a case where
I saw a Geminoid at one of these Singularity conferences, by the way.
And is it that good?
Well, you walk into a room and there's like a decapitated head in the corner there, and you're like, "Well, this is odd." It was probably a little bit earlier on where it's now, but I was a little bit, you know, I'm like, "This is going to be interesting."
Well, Paul was saying he saw the whole body and everything, and I would imagine that makes a pretty big difference because obviously you see a severed head, it never occurs to you. No matter how realistic that severed head is, it's probably just too far outside of our experience to be like, oh, sup, bro, you got a severed head over there. Like, we would instantly assume it's a prosthetic of some kind.
Yeah, but the whole body was really off-putting. So, yeah, I like Andrew's experiment where we just strip down the parts of the brain until you no longer are human. So one of those, I think, would be this oxytocin connection system. So if you're, you know, think of people with severe autism. Right, the parents really suffer a lot with these people because they, you know, the autism patients just don't connect well to other people. They're very stressed out. They're hard to hold. They're agitated, and even though you know what your child say or someone's child, it's very hard to sort of care about them. So
it's a case where, in order to get that oxytocin feeling, you need to have a response. You need to feel that connection, the humanity inside them, to feel that kinship.
Wow. And then they are sort of robotic, right?
Now do people who suffer from autism have a lack of oxytocin, or obviously you talked about the parent side of things, but what about on theirs?
On their side, they do, in fact. And then interestingly, some of the work I've done is simulated clinical trials. Even if you replace the oxytocin, you don't fix the social deficits much because the whole brain system is dysregulated, right? The whole thing's not working properly. So same thing with people with social anxiety, people with schizophrenia, depression. They really don't have this brain circuit in gear that allows them to reach out and connect to others and build those relationships. So I had dinner. Go ahead. I had dinner once with this famous woman with autism, Temple Grandin. Mm-hmm. She wrote a book called An Anthropologist on Mars. Oliver Sacks talked about her in some of his books.
HBO did a movie on her, too.
Yeah, okay. So she's very wooden, you know, and she's very fragile seeming. And she's, you know, she talks about sort of memorizing what the appropriate thing to do is, but it doesn't come naturally for her. You know, she struggles. And at dinner, she's always the first person to leave because I think it's just exhausting for her to have to go through this script as opposed to us just hanging out and, you know, having a beer. And
there's some small amount of that, and it sounds disingenuous or false, but it's like when I first got married, Bonnie and I would have, you know, these small things would escalate to very big disagreements, and only afterwards the next day would we realize that our expectations, the languages we speak are different. You know, the way I show to me, the way I want to know that I'm cared for is I want to hear it. I want this constant low level of verbal reassurance that we're on the same page, that she understands and she cares for me and so on. But for her, words are all just talky BS, and it's actions that matter. So to her, I can talk all day, a bunch of words. But the fact is, I didn't do the dishes, and so I obviously don't care for her, and she's insulted. So it for me, and none of it is natural, but it's, you know, I want it to work. So it's one of those things where I mean, much like the example you said, I memorize, where it's like, I'll think, I really want to do something. I want to tell her how much I care about her, but I'll realize that doesn't count for her. And instead, what I ought to do is go cut the freaking lawn instead.
Can we swap wives? Because I'm just like Bonnie. I'm just...
Oh, you're all visual. You're like, show me.
But, you know, the thing is, it becomes more natural. So if you're neurologically healthy, right, over time, you just remember. You don't have to think about the script. You know, you've internalized the script. But for people who can't do that, they are kind of robotic. And so what if we, again, flip it on its head? What if you have robots that are learning robots, they have artificial intelligence, and they just get better and better, and they're like, it's all about you, Brian. Man, you're the best. I love you. Every day I think about you.
Okay, so I got a question. Can you...
Yeah, Brian, robots aren't real. They don't have souls. High five.
You're like, you're not cheating at all.
Second, if I agree with you, then I'm negating your love for me.
So,
Brian, you're so smart figuring that out.
So, is it possible to induce feelings of brother kinship by injecting someone with oxytocin?
Oh, with oxytocin.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And so when we shoot synthetic oxytocin into the human brain, which I've done personally for, I don't know, 700, 800 people safely, you can turn on these connecting moral behaviors like a garden hose.
I just want to replay that last sentence you said over and over and over in my mind. Because it's like, if anybody's, if you're listening on the audio, you're not watching the video, like there was genuine, like, so anyway, you inject this into someone's brain and then total eye roll, which I've done 700 times. That may be the coolest moment that's ever happened on this podcast.
I just have this image of Paul as a Batman villain.
Yes.
Walks into a bank, sprays everybody with the Dr. Love spray.
Yes.
Give me your money. All right, we love you.
Well, so what happens when this happens? Like, can you take somebody they actively dislike and make them like them? Or is it just you take neutral people and sort of bump up, like, I don't know, I just have this vaguely good feeling about them?
Right, so we can't make people gullible. And I don't know, about 15 to 20% of people we put this on just suppress the effect anyway. So, you know, we do these experiments where we tempt people with virtue advice using money. And so when we turn oxytocin, people are sharing money with strangers, they're giving money to charity, they feel a sense of empathy towards strangers. But yeah, if you hate Andrew, I can put you on oxytocin as much as I like you, I still hate Andrew.
That's...
Which would be a reasonable thing to do.
Yeah, so don't bother with your oxytocin, because they ain't going to change nothing.
Nothing.
Me and Rosie are going to run off and start a farm. Little cyborgs.
You know, a great Twitter question on robot STDs, which I thought was great. It's, you know, the robots are going to give us some kind of computer virus that'll get into our brain and we'll turn into robots ourselves.
Oh, I didn't even think about computer viruses.
Here's we'll leave another break here for Mr. What's his face?
Mr. Old and Busted to pipe in and be a voice from the past.
I'm crying inside. I just want to remind you guys that Mark has joined the Navy to defend merchants against pirates who use light speed travel to prey upon victims. His journey leads him to the multiverse. Read the diary of Mark Selye as he explores solar systems and eventually the multiverse itself. Folks, it's Mark Selye, that's markselye.blogspot.com. Read this story for free. And remember, if you would like to purchase your own Weird Things sponsored spot, you can go head on over to weirdthings.com/sponsor. And now, back to the podcast, featuring Dr. Paul Zak and two other guys.
There has been one of the blogs I like to follow is the Kurzweil blog where they cover a lot of any sort of advancement that sort of seems to be leaning towards the singularity. And a lot of the stuff they cover is brain research. And it seems like in the last couple of years, we've been making some really good strides in building models of the human brain and getting closer and closer to getting down to replicating entire neurons and be able to put together whole structures. And what is your view of that, kind of the building the virtual brain in the box, where we are now and the likelihood of us being able to flip a switch and have a simulated brain or a Brian even?
Yeah.
Ain't happening. I just think we're not close to prime time for this. Because the system is so dynamic and nonlinear, right? It's not just a brain, but it's a brain that's doing stuff and remodeling itself all the time. And so, you know, about 100 billion neurons in your brain, each of those neurons has about 10,000 connections. And the strength of those connections is varying all the time, depending on what you do. Are you speaking French? Are you speaking Spanish? Are you speaking English? All this thing, you know, varies. So I just don't think we can get the parallelism without, you know, an entire planet worth of computers. Now, so I don't know how to crack that nut.
Well, so, okay, so that's obviously for a direct copying of all of the biochemical processes in a brain, essentially creating a quote-unquote true person, a true personality. But what about the idea of a simulation so good that no living human in day-to-day conversation – the perfect Turing test, in other words. Right. Do you believe that that we have a chance to hit that milestone?
Well – you ever met my mother-in-law? You see, she's almost robotic, so she's close. Yeah, I think we're close to that Turing test. The question is, you know, how much time do you have? If I have an hour with you, maybe I can't figure it out. If I have 10 hours, 10 days, I mean, it's a really good question, right? Turing never specified how long I have to figure that out. If I have enough time, I can probably poke and prod you. I mean, I like your idea of having organs, right? I can just take some blood from you and, you know, if it's green, then you're a robot. If it's red, you're human.
Man, can you imagine being married and, like, in year 13, you'd be like, wait a minute, you don't change ever. This is all predicted, you know, you sort of set up specific tests to see if, like that scene from Memento where she wanted to know if he really couldn't form new memories and ends up dying. Spoiler alert, sorry.
Well, you know, but it's interesting that you look at, You'll see online where you'll see the transcripts of people who are fooled by chatbots. You'll get into like the Eliza. You will have a conversation. You know, how do you feel today? I don't know. How do you feel? Well, I did da-da-da-da-da. And you realize that, one, these are people who are extremely narcissistic. They can't even realize that the person – I mean, seriously, they don't even realize the responses they're getting, because everything that's just chatbots tend to do is try to encourage you to talk more about yourself. But you think about this, that – 80 years ago, you weren't going to be able to make a machine that could really would maybe not really fool anybody. Now they fool more people, and they're getting better and better and better to the point that, yeah, it's going to be at some point, it's going to be very, very hard to fool. But let me a question I've kind of wondered is, we think we have a pretty good idea of maybe how the components work to a degree, but then we wonder if we do or not, like glial cells and stuff that are outside of the neurons, and that maybe they play a bigger role than we thought in how brains work.
Yeah. Absolutely. So again, the system's so dynamic, you know, plays electrical chemical factors. And so we're modeling it right now with just electrical factors. We're not getting all those variations that you get from washing these neurons in a variety of chemicals. And, you know, the problem is that most of these processes, 99%, are below conscious awareness. And so even from a modeling perspective, you have a brain trying to model the embodied mind. And it's not clear that we can actually get all those connections out, because there's some kind of mechanical factor that generates things like consciousness, in which there's this emergent property in which, you know, the being becomes aware of itself. So, you know, we just don't know how that works, and we're far from that. But yeah, can I fool you for a while? Probably. My first wife did, so, you know.
So I wonder, I don't know, it almost sounds like it sounds like we shouldn't even bother if what we want is – first of all, what's let me ask you guys, what's with this weird compulsion we all seem to have, our infatuation with science fiction? It's as though humanity in the last, you know, 200, 400 years is obsessed with figuring out how to create our successors. You know, to we're obsessed with the ideas of building technology to a point where we could create humanity's children that will, depending on which movies you watch, either enslave us, destroy us, or go out to the stars and be our lasting legacy for millennia to come.
I'll go first.
Yes.
We have the ability to create life now, but we have such imperfect control over that. You know, you have a child and, you know, the 38,000 different genes that are going to affect whether or not it's going to have a birth defect or what have you, and if they're going to turn out to be jerks or not. And we can do it, but we have so little control over it. But we've always had this idea of how do we take what we know, both experience-wise and aspects of our personality, and how do we continue that forward? And that's why when we imagine these machines, we imagine them as better than us in some ways, but imperfect than us, because we assume that there's still something that we don't know how to teach or communicate, because we have this sort of belief that there maybe is this magic that we don't want to acknowledge that we can't pass on. But I think it's the same reason that, you know, an amoeba would divide. It's the same sort of idea, but as we've realized all the more complex ways you can pass on information, the idea of using all of our tools to do that, I think is a very interesting idea.
Wait, are you saying that you think that our desire to create our robot android children is really just a manifestation of the biological drive to create a better version of ourselves with our kids?
Yeah.
That's amazing. I've never heard that before.
But our kids are all genetically engineered anyway, right? You chose the wife you want to reproduce with. You're investing all these crazy resources into taking them to amusement parks and giving them lessons. And so, you know, everything we're doing is genetic engineering. We're just doing it haphazardly. So what if we just genetically engineer the perfect human being?
Yeah, I like the idea that one day you and your wife, when you decide you want to have a kid, you go in and you prick your fingers and you go look at you pick and choose, you know, let's use your grandfather's eyes. Let's use those. Let's do this. Let's check, you know, choose from these. And like, oh, we both have this, you know, this recessive that's not going to be good, so we'll swap in the stock thing for a better thing than that. And I think that's going to be a good thing.
But it won't even stop there, because once you do that, there'll be this whole, there has to be a whole other side of the science that says these are various systems of ways for you to raise your children, whether or not you hit them when they're bad, whether or not you use this kind of positive reinforcement, whether or not you should bother to take any because if at that point, if at a genetic level, you know, aptitude for logic and mathematics or whatever, or a predisposition for those kinds of things, that could shape the way you raise the kid. So where not only do you build your character aesthetically and even, you know, biologically, mentally, but also you got to figure out what your programming route is, like, you know, what martial arts you're going to teach them or whatever, like from the beginning. I don't know, like at that point, if you begin on the one hand, that's the way you succeed, is begin with the end in mind. But if you already know how it ends, like, what's the point of even raising a kid at that point?
Well, but I mean, Paul, I mean, you do studies on twins and conditioning and stuff. And I mean, I would imagine there's so much complexity that comes into play that you're not going to have, you know, you'll solve some of the basic problems, but people are going to still be themselves.
That's right. Even identical twins have different expression of genes. So you know, this experiment that Brian suggested was tried by the Soviet Union, right? So when you were three or four, they just picked out what, you know, they said, you're tall. Okay, you're going to be a high jumper or whatever. And, you know, at some level that works. At another level, you get really frustrated people who don't have a passion for it, who just do it because that's the way they earn their living. So I think, you know, the missing element here is having people who really have a passion for something. Like this movie Gattaca. Remember this movie?
Oh, my God. I love Gattaca.
Great movie, right? And so at the end, when the two brothers, one who's genetically enhanced and one who isn't, you know, the one who isn't beats him in swimming in that cold, dark lake. And the brother can't believe he did it because he said, how'd you do this? He said, I was never coming back. I knew I wasn't coming back.
Yeah, he said, you want to know how I did it? I never saved anything for the swim back, which, by the way, just side note, was my attitude on Scam School from the very beginning. I was terrified because I only had like 40 episodes in mind. And I was like, what happens when I run out of episodes? And that was the scene that inspired me to just like go for broke. Do all your best material right up front. Don't save anything for the swim back.
And then, right, because otherwise, you're not going anywhere anyway.
Yeah, exactly, right? Yeah, that's a good problem to have.
But I don't think we know how to engineer that, right? How do you get a human being or a child to be so engaged and so passionate and will spend, you know, endless hours doing something? I don't know. It's this haphazard kind of process. I don't. No one really figures it out. But yeah, if your parents are violinists, yeah, you probably hear a lot of violin. You might be a good violinist. But the people, they hate it. They go, my God, I'm not going to be a violinist. It's the stupidest thing ever.
And I think to people that worry about, like, oh, what happens when you can engineer perfection, or how do we, where does it stop if you can make children taller and taller and taller, is you think that door frames are a set height. When you start making your kid 8 foot tall, they're going to have, their life is going to be miserable for them, you know, unless they decide that they're going to, you know, just live outside. Seats are a certain size. Movies are a certain length. If you're so super brilliant that you cannot sit still and be entertained for 2 hours by something that other people entertain with, you're going to want to keep a lot of these things within sort of the normal sort of human range that we have already.
Yeah, but what's normal? Normal shifts over time. I mean, normal.
Well, normal will shift over time. But I'm saying is you kind of have this idea of where you're going to have people pulling in sort of different baseline areas, and that there's, if you have certain abilities in one way, having everything expanded doesn't mean you make, you know, you, just as you have, you know, the law of squares when you talk about physical organisms and, you know, why, you know, you can't scale certain animals up too big because they collapse. Things like that work probably in the same way with kinds of creativity and intelligence, et cetera, and that you might lose other aspects of personality or patience and stuff and the drives when, you know, when you look at these studies of these, like, you know, the smartest man in the world, isn't he like a bartender, or is he like a you know, this Paul,
the like, Jeopardy, like, guy, it was a cop or something, right?
Yeah, they do the long-term studies on these extremely high IQ people, and you find out that, you know, statistically speaking, it's hard to tell that they had a high IQ by where they ended up in life.
Yeah, but having said that, there's something in genetics called a runaway process. This is like the peacock's tail. So once you get the peacock's tail and chicks like it, then you get bigger and bigger tails. So this explains Pamela Anderson's giant boobs, right?
Sure.
We know that they're not possible physically to be that big on her little frame, but we still like it anyway. So then it escalates. All the other women have to get bigger boobs, and then we like it, and then you got to do something else. So these little imperfections are actually very attractive to the brain. So like it's like the Cindy Crawford with a little mole on her face. Mm-hmm. She has the perfect face except that one little thing. We love that. It's very valuable to the brain to have one little imperfection.
That wabi-sabi.
Get that fixed.
Yeah. Isn't that the idea, the Japanese idea of wabi-sabi, the little imperfections that make it more attractive?
Make it more attractive. Yeah, exactly right. So
Navajo blankets.
That explains why Andrew's so popular. All those imperfections.
Wait a second. I don't like the way this is going.
But, you know, so I think, you know, there is a process in which if you started doing, you know, enhancements, robotic enhancements, all of a sudden your head is five times bigger than it used to be. And, you know, you're getting all these weird things happening. So, yeah, I think, you know, 100 years from now, I think humans are going to be totally weirdly enhanced and integrated totally in with robotics. And we're not going to care, actually.
You know, I think we're going to go through like a real crazy period. Like everybody who went and got, you know, tattoos, they're now regretting. You know, you like, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this. And then it kind of gets like, all right, that's okay. Yeah, we go like, that's great. And then now what, you know, and then it's like, I think that we'll go through this period of just crazy, but then it'll become so cliched that it'll then be back towards kind of looking at, you know, like the Greek or the Romantic ideals or the perfect sort of forms. And then kind of, then you maybe have some people like, you know what, there's going to be people going to want to look like Klingons. And what, they're going to have,
I mean, there's always trade-offs, right? So it's like, let's take eyeglasses. On the one hand, you get a performance benefit, right? You have a technology that enhances your vision. And I love thinking of everything like a video game. But you get like a negative half point on charisma because you deviate from that classical Greek. So it's like, which is greater, the benefit of having perfect vision or the loss of looking quite like your perfect self? And then, you know, then you have an enhancement of technology with contact lenses that gives you all the benefits. But you know, you don't lose any of the charisma points, but now you have an extra bit of effort to put these uncomfortable shards of glass into your eye every day.
Or you get LASIK and you don't have any of that and it's all benefit.
Yeah. Did you get LASIK?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. See, I was about to say that smile is spoken like a man who got LASIK.
Yeah.
Well, it's getting cheaper and cheaper. But, you know, having said that, I think Andrew might be right. Look, even Pamela Anderson reduced her boob size, right, recently. So, you know, gets to be too much, too overwhelming.
Yeah.
And we find out in evolution, too, examples of stuff when so much energy is put onto plumage or these big crowns or the big antlers or they get to a certain point, there is that big penalty where you start getting back down in size. You know, so Irish elk.
Can we do anything about it? Can we do anything about it? Is it a case where as long as Rosie the Robot has the appropriate dimensions, I won't be able to help myself but be attracted to her?
I don't think we can do anything about it. So I'll give you an example that's in the book, which is I did this experiment in the highlands of Papua New Guinea. This is like as far from the Western world as you can get. 800 distinct languages in these tiny little villages of subsistence farmers. And I mean, literally, I mean, it takes like 30 hours to get there. But you take the plane from the capital city of Papua New Guinea to the highlands, this little, you know, and there's no running water in these places. So, I mean, the smell of body odor is so overwhelming on the airplane, I thought I was going to hurl.
Wow.
I mean, it's insane. And you get to the village, and then you're there, and you're there a couple hours, and all of a sudden, people are holding your hand, they're talking to you, they're really social, because they only work an hour a day. And they do a lot of drugs, by the way, which is interesting. Wow. They're really, well, you got time, right? You don't have to worry about food, so... anyway, do a lot of drugs, and they hang out, and they talk, and all of a sudden, the smell doesn't bother you. You know, after the women have like mustaches. After a while, they kind of look cute, and you know, I don't know. You know, just we're really adaptable. So I think wherever we're going with this weird coevolution of humans and technology, we're just gonna be happy wherever we are.
See, I'm so glad to hear you say that because I think you just fixed one of my longest running movie gripes. Anytime I see anything set in the Old West, I can't stand to see them kissing each other because I know they didn't brush their teeth. I know they got stank mouth and everything smells like horse manure. And it's like, you know, I look at Lonesome Dove, which is amazing, except for the fact that everyone has perfect teeth. And I was like, they ain't got perfect teeth. Everyone's all messed up. But if I wrap my mind around the idea that this is how they see the world, and they don't see the disease and the smells and the flaws and the hideousness, then maybe I can let go and actually relax and enjoy Westerns again.
Well, who was like the prettiest girl in your middle school?
I don't even remember a single girl in middle
school. Or high school.
Even high school's
vague.
Who
was the handsomest jock in your high school?
I don't remember much from school at all, but I have a picture. I won't.
The idea is there is you think about like this is when you're the prettiest girl in school, and you think she's like the prettiest girl in school, and then you go to a bigger school or you go to a college campus, and then you go, oh my god, she was a hill beast.
Yes.
Unless you go to San Diego State, and then I remember one day having lunch on the lawn and seeing two women who were perfect hens. And I thought, oh, man, I'm in the greatest place in the world.
Like,
this is perfect
possible.
For college.
It's like a paradox.
It's like, yeah, you drive around L.A., and Mary, who we all know, I'm driving with Mary, and there was this this guy standing in front of, like, the Dolce & Gabbana store in, like, a suit and tie, holding a tray, and he's got like water drinks to give to people when they walk inside there. And this guy looked like he was on from the cover of GQ or something. Okay. He was, you know, classically handsome every single way possible. And, you know, Mary points him out and says, you know, in this town, that's an entry level job. You know, when you look like that guy.
Wow.
You know, and it's like, it's a point you realize it's like when you have all the prettiest people in the world going there and you go to a restaurant there and, you know, the girls there, the average servers, you know, can be a knockout who she was the prettiest girl in her town. But then when she comes to L.A.,
she goes to the big leagues.
Girls from
she
there,
enters
yeah.
the tournament. And
but it reminds me of being in Rio de Janeiro. And I was there and I was going in a taxi with a friend who's Brazilian, a girlfriend, and going by and seeing this woman standing on the street with like these amazing legs and short skirt and heels. And I'm like, oh, my God, gorgeous woman. And my girlfriend said, turn around and look one more time. That was a guy dressed up, a prostitute. So you got to be a little careful because you never know what you're going to get when you have enhancements.
So it turns out the same story, except it's like, it was a robot. Can you imagine how embarrassed I was?
We'll throw it to a commercial break here.
Hey, everybody. Help Dave. He's at ProfPod on Twitter. Wish his wife a sneaky happy birthday. Go on over to It's Ruth's Birthday, itsruthsbirthday.squarespace.com, and click on the Say Hello tab and wish Ruth a happy birthday. She's a big fan of this podcast, and that makes you a big fan of her. Head on over and say happy birthday, Ruth.
And we're back. Panspermia.
Well, hello.
We're back to everybody's tongue since they saw the movie Prometheus.
Oh, I thought you were still talking about Rosie the Robot.
Panspermia was an old idea that became somewhat ridiculed, and then it came back into vogue. And that is the idea that life could spread from planet to planet around the universe. And then one variation of that idea holds that maybe all life on Earth maybe came from somewhere else. And it doesn't have to be intentionally spread. It could be unintentionally spread. You say that's crazy talk. Well, Japanese scientists, doing some mathematics, calculated that if you took the asteroid impact that happened 65 million years ago, one of the major, most recent major extinction events we can point to that fundamentally shaped the landscape, gave rise to little mammals, took out the big theropods. If you look at what happened there and the amount of debris, the amount of ejecta, if you will, that was kicked up off our planet and it reached escape velocity and drifted away from the Earth forever, they have found that some of that debris could have reached by now as far away as 20 light years, including, I think it's 51 Gliese, which may or may not have a world within a Earth-type orbit, which could be in a habitable zone. There's some debate there, but 20 light years, there could be other planets, other places out there, other moons, our own solar system, said debris could have reached there. And we've reason to believe now that life, even simple cellular organisms, can survive. There's water bears, which are these little fascinating little insect-looking, I think they're related to arthropods. You can freeze those suckers for 10 years and put them in the vacuum of space, bring them back in, rehydrate them, they come back alive.
What?
When we've talked about this before, when we brought back one of the cameras that we sent to one of the first lunar probes before we put men there, and then 10 years later we took this camera back from the moon, we put it back into the lab and opened it up, found some sort of crystalline structure there, sprayed it with water, and realized that somebody had sneezed and there was viable bacteria there. So some things can survive. Now, there's a half, like a million and a half years is like the half-life for DNA. But we find things like Deinonychus or whatever. I think it's a bacterium that can rebuild its DNA structure. You find this in the middle of nuclear venting pools. So, panspermia, Earth may have impregnated galaxies.
That's amazing because I knew that it was possible for ejecta from an impact to leave lower gravity bodies like Mars. Obviously, we have meteorites that fell from Mars. But I just assumed that the Earth was too heavy to really make it work. And certainly, I don't know, man, that just seems crazy that that the odds of an impact of that size while life is happening, the odds that ejecta escapes Earth's velocity, the odds that it happens to have a creature that can survive that long, the odds that of all the directions it'll go, it lands in another appropriate star system, odds that it lands on another planet in that star system, and the odds that it survives impact when it lands, and the odds that it happens to be an organism that can thrive on photosynthesis or chemosynthesis.
Let's back up, though. Let's reel this back in, though, okay?
All right.
One, we've had multiple extinction events that were probably caused by maybe the same-sized asteroids going back a billion years or so, and we've had life on this planet for over a billion years. So you could have had 10 events like that, and you could have had stuff going out there into, 200, 300, 400 light years of space.
Right.
Okay? Life is everywhere on this planet. Life is everywhere. Sometimes you don't see the signs of this life, but you dig down into rock, you find things living there. So it's hard to grab a rock or to find a big substantial piece of material and not find life. Life will be there, okay? So that's one thing. Whatever it kicked up, whatever this asteroid kicked up, there will be life on it. Will that life survive? Another question. Okay.
By the way, that was a very well-timed text message somebody just got.
So we know the life would be on it. Would the life survive the impact? The other thing, that's a big question. What happens when it goes outside of the Earth and it starts drifting? Remember, it's going in outwards in this sphere. Eventually, it's going to feel the attraction. If it leaves our solar system, it's going to come into some other solar system. given enough time.
Yeah, I guess so.
Okay, and it'll drift towards there. And maybe, I mean, there's somebody who, you know, physicist or somebody smart like Paul could correct me on this, but it's going to drift towards another solar system. And the largest body would ideally would probably be the sun there, but it's going to be pulled towards large bodies.
So, you know what? I'm going to back up on this and say I do see that this could happen because I've been playing an iOS game called Plague Inc., where your stated goal is to destroy all of humanity. And you level one is you play as a bacteria, and there's certain rules with bacteria, and you could play on easy level where nobody washes their hands and everyone gives hugs to the sick, or there's hard level where the hardest level was where the sick are thrown in jail and everybody washes their hands like crazy. But one, as I play the game tactically, thinking in terms of I want to infect everyone and kill them, there's a certain level that I know all I have to do is get into this country, and then it's just a matter of time. And then the way you play the game is by accepting or rejecting certain mutations that are advantageous or disadvantageous. And so, I don't know, when I think about it that way, where it's like, let's figure for sake of discussion that 100% of the Earth is infected with life. And let's say a wandering moon comes swinging into our galaxy and full-on demolishes all of planet Earth, sending all the mass of planet Earth in every direction out there. I just think back to, like, all I got to do is get into Egypt, and then I just got to wait. And now Egypt is mine.
I'll throw you another thing, and then we're gonna pull some questions in with Paul so we can get some actual intelligence here.
Yes.
That was a very good point, though, Brian. There is in atmospheric physics, there's a thing called plasmoids, which basically you've seen the diagram where they show the Earth or the magnetic field and the lines going off there, and our field protects us from radiation, and we've kind of got this tail into space.
Mm-hmm.
A plasmoid, when you look at, let's say, the aurora borealis, and you see these radiating things, a plasmoid's basically like this little electrical field that turns into kind of like almost like ball lightning and just drifts away from the Earth. Okay, when it does that, bits of atmosphere go along with there. And we find that we're finding more and more, and higher up in the atmosphere, we're finding biological, you know, organisms.
Wait a minute. And so you're saying like almost like drifting on the solar wind, our atmosphere and our bacteria just constantly sweeping out into space where it drifts for, oh my God, that's a game changer for me, because if that's possible and if it's the type of bacteria that is hardened against radiation, that can survive in a vacuum, that can reanimate on reentry, and who even says it has to be a nasty reentry? It could just gently drift down into the atmosphere of an Earth-like planet light years away.
Earth burp, right? Little Earth burp. Yeah,
exactly. And I can't remember the name offhand. There's a scientist, and it's a fringe theory, and it's been a fringe theory for some time, but the idea that some of the plagues and some of the things we get on Earth.
Space plagues.
The Andromeda strain was based upon a similar idea to that. And, you know, we live in this, and the kind of the curious thing to think about is that if you got little strands of DNA from Earth DNA that went off to other planets, to other moons, and somehow became the starting point for life, there are a lot of things we talk about, oh, when we meet other life, it's going to be so different than us. We have things like chirality and the shape of proteins and et cetera. But all that would be very similar because it had the same starting point from us. And our universe, or excuse me, our galaxy, you know, our universe is maybe, 17 billion years old? And if you had, after that first generation of stars that formed that then gave us nitrogen and oxygen and all that, and then you started to have life, you could have life 10, 15 billion years ago maybe.
Yeah.
And before our solar system formed, and that was all drifting out through space.
That's the same excuse they gave on Star Trek, by the way, for why all of the aliens look like humans with lumpy foreheads, was that there was an original humanoid species from which they were all derived.
Yeah, but that was intentional. Yeah, they went around and like, all right, Dr. Paul Zak.
So here's why it's all bogus.
All right.
You go out to space, you get close to the sun, all that radiation does all kind of damage to your DNA, all becomes messed up, mutated, most of it dies. You need to be really lucky, damn lucky, to actually have any of that survive, all that solar radiation outside the atmosphere.
Have you seen the video of Deionychus Radioactive?
We don't want to give this up.
I love the response, which is A, That's not a theoretical basis.
But have you watched this viral video? The cat's really cute.
It's literally a viral video. Well, actually, it's bacterial.
What is the video you're talking about?
I haven't. Show us.
Have you seen? So what it is, it's they getting this spelling right now. It's Dionysus Radio Durans. Duran Duran. Haircut 100. Okay. So basically, this was they weren't sure what this thing was first, but they were using gamma radiation to sterilize canned food, because you know when you talk about different levels of how to have a clean environment, first you know use water and then use soap and water. Well, then we'll put it in the autoclave and we'll heat it up, right? And then you bleach, and then you get into like that, and then like the highest level when you want to have like a government facility that works with like bioweapons and stuff. Use radiation, because radiation kills everything.
Well, and all of these are just different ways to shuck and jive and make the area as unpleasant as possible for whatever living things are in there.
Right. Yeah, and you start off with like bursting the cell membrane, you know, things that would do that, and then heating it, which would burst it, and then you get it. Once you start getting to radiation, the idea is let's just screw up the DNA and just mess up all the interior thing, and it's just going to dissolve. Well, they found a bacterium that existed when we didn't think that it should have been, and they sequenced the genome, they looked at this thing, and they actually have time-lapse video where you can see this thing get broken apart by, they may have used a chemical agent or radiation, where all the little DNA fragments are broken apart, okay? The DNA
is destroyed at the molecular level, essence of what this thing is.
And then they go back in and they reassemble themselves bit by bit by bit by bit by bit.
Life finds a way.
And it's you know, it's fascinating because it's finds a way to, you know, what's that, Paul?
He's correcting me. Love finds a way. As long as we're talking about Rosie.
Well, they love that. So it's kind of curious because our understanding, and I agree that, like, you know, we said like in a million and a half years with DNA, it seems to be at that point you're it's hard to get recoverable stuff back because it's just radiation and space is filled with it. But we're finding these little complex chemical structures that some way are going to play by their own rules.
So then, you know, you're right. Life wants to be alive, and so it's going to try to find any way. But as Brian said, you need millions and millions and millions of combinations before you hit one that actually works, land someplace where it's hospitable, has, you know, enough energy to generate itself and replicate and all that. So possible, but improbable, I would say.
So it's to me, maybe this is the magician in me, or there's all these scams that are based on the idea of a series of statistical probabilities. So like we could play a game that let's say it's a knock the bottles over game, and you have an 80% chance of hitting them, and you're like, oh no, this is easy, I can do it almost, you know, 4 out of every 5 times. But if I were to offer you a bet that you could do it 3 times in a row, that is a fundamentally different proposition, because each time you do it, there's a 80% chance that you'll make it the first time. Then there's an 80% chance of that 80% chance. And at some point, the odds swing wildly in the favor of the house. And that's how a lot of these scams work. And so, but it seems like we have competing versions of these, right? It's like it takes an extraordinary number of coincidences to get a chunk of rock with a piece of viable life on a solar system, on a planet 3 light years away. And it, for each of those, it just seems like the odds get so astronomical that it becomes undoable. But on the flip side, there's also a number of insane number of trials to things that we expect to kill life that keeps not killing life. And it seems like a set of coincidences that I mean, I want to. I think we're all rooting for there to be aliens for some reason. I want to believe that is possible.
Well, I just interject. Like, I throw this out here. I have no idea what I actually believe on that, but my role is to sort of make the most persuasive weird argument I can. One of the things is when we talk about knowns and unknown, you know, known unknowns and stuff. And when we started looking at DNA and we started thinking about how life arised on Earth, and we were filled with these ideas, there were all these inconceivable things that had to happen just right. But the more we learned, we find out that, well, you know, if you have chemicals, which we now know, organic molecules, which are abundant in our universe. If you have liquid and you have heat and you stir this thing up and you let it stir for a million years, you're mathematically going to get this inevitability kind of stuff. And there's a reason why a lot of scientists think it's inevitable to find life out in space, because the math seemed much more of a likelihood than we realized before. I'm still skeptical we'll ever find intelligent life.
Sure.
It's because I don't know that there is any statistical advantage to that. But
So riddle me this. Panspermia, you're saying not at all from star system to star system, right, Paul?
I don't think so.
What about it within the solar system? Like, is there a chance a chunk of Earth rock has landed on Europa and we'll find, and that would be the reason that we find some kind of gizmo at the bottom of the sea thriving on the heat from the core?
I mean, maybe. You'd have to have the right kind of, mutation as it's flying through space, as getting hit with all these rays from the sun, in which, you know, it's adapted or it's reasonably adapted to live in that kind of place. So I think it's pretty unlikely, but I agree with Andrew. I think there's going to be lots of life out there. It's just going to be single cell, some kind of weird little silicon-based, you know, something life. It won't look like Klingons.
Now, do you think here's an interesting one. So let's say, 8,000 years in the future, a robotic mission, one of several that we're doing all over the galaxy, lands, and finally we find our first extrasolar life. We're thinking 100% parallel evolution, where it bears a marked resemblance to our DNA and carbon-based life, or do you think it's something so wildly unpredictable? Because it seems to me that there's a reason that we exist the way we do, and that whatever these rules are that the universe is based on would dictate that most likely something other life we encountered would bear a striking resemblance, because, like, things that fly tend to look like birds. And it seems to me like things that live would tend to have, double helix DNA.
I don't know. I think they'd be adapted to their own environment, right? So, and I guess the assumption is that the physics hold everywhere. So I think that's now in question with a multiverse. So it could be that it's maybe really simple to get life because you're living in some parallel, universe in which, the rules of physics are flipped on their head, and therefore you don't need whatever 23 chromosomes. You only need one or something.
I tell you, like, my brain starts to explode when I question all the very foundations of what I perceive the world to be and life around us. And I start to wrap my mind around, inside stars, you got stuff that does things and you have energy. So why not have a form of life that exists, thrives, lives within the heart of a star and, or rock even or something.
I'll dial it back. I'm going to tell you what the big controversy is going to be in xenobiology in the later part of the 21st century when we go to other planets and moons within our solar system and we find organisms. We're going to go, did it come from Earth?
Right.
And we're going to go like, yeah, life. And then it's going to be like, oh, but did it just come from us? Is that it? And it's going to be this, we're going to have this sort of, we'll have this amazing discovery, but then we're going to be like, yeah, but maybe that meteor impact sent it from here, and it's just, and it's going to, for some reason, what would be the most exciting discovery is going to get reeled back, and looking how far back we've had, meteor impacts, like I said, I mean, you could probably have 300 to 400 light years.
Right, so what you're saying is...
You could arguably say that it came from Earth.
Right. Well, and it's one of those things. This is the God of the gaps phenomenon, where it's like there's always mystery. No matter how many answers we get, there's that little crevice in between that it's like, now that's what we want to solve. It's like, okay,
yeah, but it's,
we
it's
know gonna, there's aliens, but we also know that they came from us. Are there any aliens that didn't come from us?
And that's going to say is that we're gonna have to have that boundary. It's going to have to be like beyond 300 light years. Once we go beyond there, we'll really know. And the problem will be then is, and I don't think we'll ever have faster than light travel, but it'll still be like, yeah, but... somebody could have gone ahead of us, this mission that went missing here. And then it'll be like a 300 or 400 year light year window that I'll be like that, because we'll be able to know if we find it outside of there. And
so it's like
in the rock for a million years.
It's like a million years from now, there's school children, on some far outpost of the Milky Way sitting there saying like, we may never know if there's life in Andromeda.
Exactly.
You're always setting up the next mystery.
Right. Or what if we actually seeded life all through the solar system by all the probes we sent to Mars and Venus and the moon? And, we wait for 100 years, all of a sudden there's little moon gooblies, running around. And they weren't there. They just came from hitching a ride on some, lunar lander.
I'll tell you what, I think both ends of the tale are cool. I can be inspired by a vision of the world where there's other intelligent life out there waiting to be discovered. And I can be satisfied that, we, like on Star Trek, like, we're the precursors. We're the first. And it's for us to create history's children.
I love the idea that it's ours.
You want to be the only one.
You want to play God, I see.
Then we don't get into the ethical thing of, like, killing the natives.
Yeah, sure.
Or being the natives.
What if they kill us? What if they we bring them back and they just take over and exactly. they become robots?
Look, I mean, there's when Stephen Hawking starts getting nervous about, like, I hope there are no aliens because they would definitely kill us, you know? It's like, then I get nervous for sure.
Yeah, it's I don't, his premise is very faulty. Stick to the physics, Stephen.
He can outwheel him anyway. It's no big deal. Yeah,
yeah,
moving that
yeah he already talks like one. So
you're one of them.
There's no human here. Eliminate, destroy, eliminate, destroy. He's driving down the street with his wheelchair with a shotgun hooked up to the friggin' throat switch.
That's right. Zombies, killing the zombies.
Yeah.
Come with me if you want to live.
Another imaginary commercial break.
Oh, man. It's depressing how hilarious and really, really smart this episode is. I'm going to have to soothe my nerves by going to indielove.com. That is indie-love.com. It's a website dedicated to covering independently developed video games. It's where all the cool stuff is happening these days. Not the big AAA titles. Sure, we all play those and like them. But there's some amazing stuff going on in independent video games. Look at that Fez. Did you play that Fez? Ah, amazing. Also, you can check out their Amazon store. Give a little kickback to the guys that write it. Come on, man. Support them. Because they're indie. They're indies covering indies. Indie-love.com.
So, Paul, do you see Prometheus?
What is this Prometheus of which you speak? No, I'm not allowed to see movies.
What?
All right. Do you mind if Brian and I do kind of a spoilery discussion of it?
We got to keep it short, though, because I've got proofreading that I'm supposed to be doing, and we're already 75 minutes in.
All right, Brian, you want us to do picks? We'll do the discussion next week with Justin.
You know what? I think that'd be a really good idea. Okay, cool. I think
more
we'll
people have a chance to see it, too. That's
yeah,
cool.
There we go. That way we won't spoil anything. Okay, so let's talk about picks. My pick is in advance of it's actually not even out yet. It's a fantastic tale of high adventure. It's electric. It's fully immersive. It is unlike any book out there, and it comes out on June 19th. That's right. I'm talking about Scam School Book 2, Fire, available on the Kindle Fire and the iTunes iBookstore. Look, if you don't know, I've been crawled into a hole for 2 weeks writing. I found out I don't understand how you can write so many books, Andrew. It is so hard to tease words out of me and craft them in a way. Like, we were up against deadline, and I wrote the last 10,000 words of Scam School Book 2 in 4 days, and it just about slayed me. Bonnie had to take the kids out of town in order for me to get it all done. But
and strand them alone in a forest.
But I'll tell you what, though. I'm doing the final proofreading tonight, and it looks amazing. It's got...
wow, looks like an iPad. I'm impressed.
Holding up nothing here. It looks amazing. It actually... is it's bigger than book one by a lot. It's 33% bigger. It's got 65 video illustrations. It's got audio commentary.
Looks fantastic, Brian.
I'm extraordinarily proud of it. There you go. You can see.
Well, Brian, if I can get an advance copy, maybe it'll be my pick next week.
Oh my gosh, I will do that as soon as it'll be finished tonight. We're gonna press publish. I'm gonna push it tonight, and then I'm gonna start sending out preview copies to all my BFFs. So I'll send one to both of you guys.
That sounds great.
I'm going to do my pick.
My book took 4 years. I don't know how you guys do it.
It's called reduced quality.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, you're just smarter.
Every now and then, that's the explanation. So every now and then, ever since I was a kid, I remember like the first time I read a book and all of a sudden everything sort of came together. And I understood like, okay, maybe not all of this is true, but it's such a neat way to look at things, and it changed my outlook. And the first time I could think that happened was when I read The Naked Ape by Desmond Morris. And I loved the idea because he said, you know, let's look at human beings as if we were just zoologists, not treat us as any sort of special animal that needed some special human-centric way to look at us. But if we were aliens, and use that example, aliens coming down to Earth to look at people, how would we look at a human the same way we would at a chimpanzee, a monkey, or any other animal? And first, we would look at the pelt. We'd look at this. And it was a really, really great book to sort of just examine what made us who we are. And when you realize that we were just sort of naked apes, it was absolutely fascinating. I would say the next time I had that kind of experience, maybe was Richard Dawkins' The Selfish Gene.
Yeah, which sure.
Was this great idea of looking at genes, looking at life from a gene-centric point of view,
where it's like the animals are not the biggest players, but in fact the gizmos driving the things that drive the animals.
Yeah, because the genes are the constant. The genes are the things that have been driving evolution for millions of years, and it was a wonderful way to look at that. You look at if you wanted to explain sex selection, all these other things that come into play. Or anyhow, I love that. Blind Watchmaker by Daniel Dennett. Darwin's Dangerous Idea by Daniel Dennett. Blind Watchmaker's Dawkins. Darwin's Dangerous Idea by Daniel Dennett was one of those. Matt Ridley, Origin of Virtue, was one of these kind of these real kind of epiphanies, a great amazing synthesis.
Right.
And then I would say Blank Slate was Thank another you. Just a fantastic one, because it was just this idea. Let's take this idea that people are born without any sort of
tabula rasa.
Yeah, you know, and let's examine this and find out, no, we have all these drives, all these other things that come into us, and that you cannot engineer people through society the way some people had tried in the 20th century, that there is – and there are actually good qualities of humans. And then another epiphany, and it came before I read the book, but it came from knowing Dr. Paul Zak mm-hmm. and the role that oxytocin played, and how much of our behavior, how much of who we are really was decided, you know, by this – hormone oxytocin, which is something that we, through the process of evolution, we've evolved to embrace and to be receptive to, because there are so many advantages to that. One of the things that makes human beings so special, when you look through all those books and you go, what makes us different? And one of the things I think it's Matt Ridley's talked about, you don't see two chimpanzees pick up a 2x4 and help each other carry it. They will cooperate in some ways, but in other ways, they're totally incapable of it. When you look at cultures that really succeed, it's because they can trade, because they have these ideas of reciprocity. And it's not just because this was just this idea they stumbled onto. It's because somewhere in our biology, something clicked. And so the next big epiphany is The Moral Molecule by our guest here, Dr. Paul Zak, which is a fantastic look into how – you know, how this affects us, how so much of our behavior, how much of just what we what makes us human is decided by, you know, a simple, and it's not reductionism. People get into this, oh, it's overtly reductionist, but it's not. But it's a sort of thing that says that if you're going to have a thing that works like cooperation or love, there are things that make that work. They just do not exist independent as abstract ideas. They are based in biology, and Dr. Zak has done a fantastic job of illustrating that. So that's my pick, is The Moral Molecule.
Thank you so much. What a nice thing to say, especially than anything my mother said about me. So,
yeah. What's going on the shelf next to Ridley, next to Dawkins,
Pinker? That's great. Well, it is fun, and I think, you know, one of the thank you for saying that. But one of the values is going from the molecules all the way up to society. Like, mm-hmm. how do we get civilization? How do we get people who are magicians, who have podcasts, who like? How do you get paid? You don't, you know, grow any of your own food. You don't have your own sheep. And we all are in this web of cooperation. Again, you can break down, but once you have that web of cooperation, you get greater specialization, more prosperity, and actually greater empathy and connection to others. So we actually have the luxury of, you know, zooming around all kinds of places, Papua New Guinea and crazy weddings and magic shows and meeting all kinds of nice people. And they'll sometimes even pay us to hang out with them. You know, that's a heck of a nice world. It actually makes the world a better place. So more prosperous countries are more tolerant, more trustworthy, and happier. And that's actually a really exciting thing, that this is all working towards, you know, to accept that we can, improving human life.
What I like too is that, you know, we had conversations where you disabused me of many of my silly notions. And there was a, and particularly in the 90s, there was this sort of craze to sort of like to start declaring regions in the brain, that this does this and this does this. And because we were very, very, very much into sort of software, hardware metaphors for stuff because of what was going on and that.
It was like
something that was a kind of a much more testable idea, in that, you know, we've known for, gosh, probably 70, 80 years, what percentage of the population was a sociopath. Like 2%.
Yeah.
And you could, in your laboratory with your oxytocin research, you could peg right away pretty much, I mean, who they were, right?
Who they are, right. Just with a blood test. So I think it gives us this. So we have this notion of sort of rocket thrusters. You know, we have to live around this sea of strangers. That's the hand evolution dealt us. And, you know, we know a lot about the thruster that takes us towards aggression, towards fear. But we really didn't have a rocket thruster that moved us towards cooperation, towards trust, towards, you know, finding that value in relationships. And that missing little rocket thruster was oxytocin. And, you know, it was just sitting on the shelf for someone to find. I mean, it was just begging to be, you know, examined. And so now we have two sides of that rocket thruster. And, you know, you can screw this system up, right? So, I don't know. Brian gets in my face, calls my kids ugly. He's going to get a beat down, right? So
from your kids. Hand,
your kids are beautiful, by the way, just for the record.
But, you know, on the other hand, most of the time we cooperate because there's great value in doing that. That sustains us as social creatures in our social group, which we need. So we think about how we punish, you know, prisoners in jail who misbehave. You put them in solitary confinement, right? Because that's very stressful psychologically and physiologically. So, you know, the flip side of that is, well, why do we need other people? Why does it make us happy to be around the humans? Why do people with rich social networks live longer and healthier? Oh, there must be some mechanism in the brain that says, hey, you should stick around these people.
I'm going to get political for a second, and not too contemporary, but sort of
great.
A broader.
Here it comes, Obama 2012. Go ahead and say it.
Yeah, we knew it.
In the history of the 20th century, and this was a thing that Steven Pinker talked about, was the idea of these sort of these two different battles, you know, between the idea of engineering society, engineering people, as you talk about the communists sort of did, and then the idea of the individual and the idea of the people left to their own devices within reason will tend to create the things that you would consider ideal or good. And are we making a mistake in some ways in trying to engineer too much in society, charity or kindness, or trying to sort of have this sort of, is the top-down approach going to be inherently flawed if it starts with the molecule?
Yeah, it is flawed, right? It's flawed because it means that a small group of people are choosing goals for a whole bunch of people who may not agree with those goals. And so, again, because society is this complex adaptive system, very nonlinear, what we're seeing now is this de-evolution towards decentralization. Is that a word, de-evolution? Anyway, everything's getting decentralized. The size of businesses is getting smaller. The size of our social networks is getting bigger because now we're drawing on those networks. And so I think the companies that are very decentralized, the societies that are decentralized, are the ones that are the most adaptive. You know, it does mean that you have this sort of creative destruction problem, where, you know, you do need to have some kind of social safety net because jobs are being created, industries are changing, governments are changing rapidly. On the other hand, everyone wants this, right? Look at Egypt, look at Syria, look at these people who are literally dying just to have freedom of choice and not have people tell them what to do. And so I think we have to live in this world of greater uncertainty, but also greater freedom. And that's made possible by having this mechanism in your head that says, you know, Brian safe, Andrew not safe. I mean, if you can't just do that, if we can do that, then we can organize ourselves into who we want to be around, who we're comfortable being around, who's going to be valuable to be around, and who's not. But also, I think it also means that we have to have a little bit of toleration that, you know, I can have a bad day. So the book we talk about, inhibitors to oxytocin release, stress hormones, testosterone, your developmental history, what happened to you as a kid. And so everyone is going to behave morally all the time, just a fact. And we should say, that's okay, right? That's all right. Doesn't mean you're a bad person. Means you're having
a bad day. I told the judge.
Means you're having a bad day. So it means we need to be a little bit forgiving, a little bit understanding. And so I think the book gives people a language to discuss that. You know, instead of saying, hey, Brian's always been great to me, and, you know, and today he screamed at me, so he's a bad person, right? All these years I was wrong. I've just understood now he's a very bad person. Instead of say, look, he's having a bad day. Right, he was under a lot of stress. He had to write 10,000 words in 4 days. He didn't get very much sleep, and therefore his brain is working in a way that puts him in survival mode, and he just needs to curl up and sleep for 20 minutes. Right, and that's all right. So anyway, I think that's kind of the implication of this. I should say that politically, one of the crazy experiments we did, which is in the book, is giving oxytocin to Democrats, Republicans, and Independents.
Oh, that's awesome! I haven't read the book, so I want to hear about this.
Okay, so the short answer is that we can actually change the political preferences of Democrats, but not Republicans. So we put Democrats on oxytocin. All of a sudden, they like Republican candidates more, substantially more. You put Republicans on oxytocin, they don't change their preferences at all.
That's
so, again, you can interpret that a couple ways. You can say, well, Democrats are more open-minded, and therefore they're more open to these other influences. Or you can say, how beautiful it is that Republicans really have these views, you know, that and they're true believers.
Well,
independence, you can move them all around.
Well, have you seen the research on the theory of mind between Democrats and Republicans?
No. What's this?
Oh, they tried to see who was better at modeling the other person's point of view, Democrats or Republicans. The Democrats were consistently incapable of articulating the Republican point of view. Republicans were very good at having a very good theory of mind to Democrats. And when you look at the language each one uses about the other, you sort of see that because the Republicans don't vilify Democrats in the same way. They consider them naive, you know, idealistic, but not in the real world, where the Democrats tend to say, you know, they're fascist, they're evil or whatever. And that was sort of in the theory of mind modeling was fascinating to see.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this last episode of Weird Things Live after we cave to political pressure and go off the air.
The Democrats will shoot us.
Yeah.
We're off the air.
We're Jedi Party here. So
there you go.
Well, great fun. I think, you know, there's so much we don't know about the brain that, you know, it's fascinating to be able to look inside and poke the brain and see what happens to the humans. They're a fascinating species.
Paul, do you have any picks? Any recommendations or...
I'm reading a fabulous book, which is about 10 years old. It is a biography of Walt Disney by Neil Gabler.
Neil Gabler.
Gabler, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's been on my kind of to-read list for quite a while, and it is, he's a highly creative but flawed individual who built an empire, which is at once gorgeous and stupid. Like, how do you do that? You know, what happened to this guy in his life? And the answer is a ton of stuff. So, yeah, well, halfway through, it's really fun.
Right on.
Yeah. I love that book. Absolutely loved it. Absolutely loved the book.
Yeah, great
big
fun.
Big Disney thing.
Man, I guess that's so, it. That's we saved the universe, didn't we?
Yeah.
From the robots.
Paul did.
From the robots by just saying, boo, humans. We're it. We're all that exists in this cold, dark, empty void, unless something developed elsewhere.
Well, maybe. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, this has been the Weird Things Podcast. It's been weird.
You want to sponsor the podcast? Do you have $30? If so, go to weirdthings.com/sponsor, and you can have Justin say whatever you want. He's a trained ape.